Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Well, as New York City continues to reopen, one of the key issues is how do we ensure that it reopens and evolves on in an equitable way? And our next guest probably has some thoughts on that. Brad Lander, New York City comptroller candidate. He's also a veteran New York City council member from Brooklyn. Brad, thank you so much for taking the time here. Again, as New York City continues its reopening, there are definitely some concerns here that some of the funds that have been allocated for that reopening, that they be allocated in an equitable way. Give us your thoughts on how that may develop.
Thank you, Paul and Matt. It's great to be with you, and I think your point is a good one. We're getting this one-time federal funding. We've got about $14 billion coming in from American Rescue Plan and CARES funding. And there's a lot of questions about it. You know, is it being distributed equitably? Are we making sure that every neighborhood, especially those hit hardest by COVID that had those lines outside the hospitals and food banks, that we're investing in small business reopening? There's a lot of other questions as well. We want to make sure we're investing that money in things that will help prime the economy, that are one-time investments and don't create recurring obligations that hit our city budget in future years after the federal money dries up.
Yeah, I just, you know, the question about how you track the funds and what you do if they're not spent wisely, it just seems to me in general, and this isn't specific to Brooklyn or New York, we pay far too much in taxes for what we actually get. The government spends a lot more on stuff than I would if I were buying that stuff. How do you deal with that kind of spending run amok?
Well, look, what we need New York City to be is a place that people want to keep coming and creating and innovating and doing business, where culture's thriving, where businesses are thriving. Like, that's what makes New York City special. And I will say, you know, Mike Bloomberg made clear when he was mayor, like, we're not going to be able to, like, charge you the least in taxes to make New York City what it needs to be to have the technology and the education and the public safety and the thriving neighborhood. So to me, it's less, you know, can we tax people less and more? Can we deliver a city that's thriving and that spreads those benefits around more equally?
No, completely agree. It's not about, I completely agree with you. It's not about taxing people less. I'm willing to pay what I pay, even a little more. It's about getting value for that money, spending it in the right way.
Agreed. And look, I think in economic development, we have some compelling models. The Brooklyn Navy Yard, you know, publicly owned, city-owned land, working with the Brooklyn Navy Yard Development Corporation, creating a platform for technology and clean energy companies, creating good jobs. You know, I like the model of the new Cornell Tech campus on Roosevelt Island. So, yes, I think when we have this one-time money, that's a lot of it is for economic reopening, there is an opportunity to track it and to make sure it's going into the kinds of investments that do that. But right now, we're really not doing that at all. It's almost impossible to tell where the money's going, how much is just for basic public health services, how much is to help our kids come back and recover socially, emotionally, academically, and how much is going into economic recovery. So that's step one. As controller, what I want to do one day, you know, in the first 100 days is put that tracking system up. The state controllers actually put something like this up. And then, yeah, like, use it to show where we are and aren't tracking outcomes. And then be able to show folks like you, this money is being spent in ways that will deliver a thriving economy and a more equal one. Today, I can't do that. So I'm not going to argue with you today. Today, that money is being spent fairly willy-nilly without a lot of strategy or a lot of good tracking. It's going to be on the next mayor to put a budget out that really does a more strategic job. As controller, what I'm going to do is shine a spotlight on it, provide the data, you know, enable people to look and see, is this going in the ways that we want it to?
Hey, Brad, a recent Bloomberg City Lab analysis found that New York City has spent the most on overtime pay than the five biggest cities. It also found that the excessive overtime has led to higher pension payments, because it counts all the overtime pay when calculating pensions for the New York City Police Department. What will you do to change that?
Yeah. I've been a longtime critic of this. That City Lab report, you know, really put it in black and white. But a bunch of us have been saying this for a long time. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars of overtime beyond what was budgeted. Like, everyone has just treated the budget as like some numbers. It's okay if you blow through. And that's not, this kind of goes to what you were saying before. If that was getting us improved public safety, you might still ask questions about it. But at the moment, it's not. We spend more per capita. We have, even before overtime, substantially more police per capita than any other big city in the United States, more than L.A., more than Austin, more than Houston. And
they don't do very much,
beyond that.
I got to say, last
beyond that.
Yeah, I got to say, last time I was up on 125th Street, I saw a group of people ride by on clearly stolen motorcycles. I watched somebody doing a out-in-the-open drug deal on the corner in the middle of the day, and people were shoplifting in Duane Reade. There were cops on each corner, and they did nothing about any of it. How does that change?
And then even beyond that, as the study showed, you know, we're spending a lot on overtime, and there's some real questions about, is that oriented to achieving public safety, or is that oriented to boosting pensions? Look, I think there are some more promising ways to invest resources in keeping communities safe. I'm a big fan of these violence interrupter programs, these cure violence programs that are starting up in a lot of neighborhoods, and the city's putting more money in. But we really do need to track, what are we getting for that money? And I'd give one more example. You know, I talk to a lot of people who are saying, you know, the subways don't feel as safe to me. I'm more likely to see someone who seems mentally ill, who seems like they might be homeless. You know, but what's effective there is providing supportive housing and mental health treatments that help those folks both be and live safely, as opposed to having somebody pull them off the subways when they're going to get right back on tomorrow. So, you know, I think we can bring a lot more data to the conversation about what keeps our communities safe.
Do we have data? By the way, I'm in Berlin, Germany right now, and I noticed last night there's no traffic, or at least nothing compared to New York. Do we have data showing that congestion pricing can really solve this issue without being a regressive tax on commuters?
Yes. I mean, the short answer, you know, there is, you know, look, there's a balance. You're not going to both get dramatic congestion reductions and dramatic increases in what you can invest in public transit. Like, those things are going to happen in some inverse relationship to each other. But, you know, the examples from London are pretty good. They have somewhat reduced traffic and substantially increased resources for transit investment. And I mean, it'll be really important that as the system gets stood up here, we are watching really carefully and we're balancing between those goals. And, you know, we want both those things. We want both less traffic and more money for transit. We're not going to be able to get them, you know, to get them both. And as the system gets tweaked, it is important that we really limit exceptions or exemptions. Like, we need a system that isn't, like, you know, so means tested, you know, that it isn't achieving its broad traffic and transit goals. Yep. But I'm a longtime supporter, been fighting for it for a couple of decades, and I'm glad it's about to happen.
Brad, thank you so much. Brad Lander, their comptroller candidate. Let's talk about what really wealthy people are doing, high worth net individuals in these markets. Michael Sonnenfeld joins us. He is the chairman and the founder of Tiger 21. They've got a collective $85 billion in assets under management. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. So what do wealthy investors think about the stock market right now? We're hovering near all-time record highs, and there seem to be so many headwinds that Mr. Market is just ignoring.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, our members are in a period where they're concerned about inflation, labor costs, and supply chain issues. But at the same time, over 11% of their assets are in startups and venture capital. That's an all-time high. And, of course, the public markets are the exit for those startups. And so there's more innovation going on. So our members are trying to counteract their concerns. We only have 25% in public equity. It's our second largest allocation. But these are very interesting times, and climate and energy is first and foremost on their mind, but labor and inflation as well.
Michael, I know you're members of, as you mentioned, entrepreneurs, all walks of business, of the economy. What are you hearing from them in terms of these supply chain issues that we hear about, you know, seemingly here for months now, and they don't really show any signs of abating anytime soon.
Sure. You know, there's been a debate about the Fed. I'm using an example about whether inflation is transitory or now in a new trend, and it's the same issue on the supply chain. Is this the bullwhip effect of coming back to work from the pandemic, new ways of working, offices, and so forth? Are we in a fundamental shift of supply chain of epic proportion? And it's too early to tell, but anybody who discounts does it at their peril. One thing to note, though, is as the economy becomes more data-driven or high-tech-driven, the supply chain issues are in the physical world, but in the internet world, in the digital world, the supply chain issues are a little less critical. And as these issues are more a higher percentage of the economy, that's why the stock market seems to still not be being destroyed by these supply chain issues. It's a wonder to our members, but they're playing on a rapidly changing landscape.
So what about the labor shortage? I mean, you have you run businesses that employ people. Your members run businesses that employ people. What are they hearing when they try and hire, or where else are those people? What else are those people doing with their time?
So we now have we just crossed the 1,000 member mark. We're in 5 countries and over $100 billion in assets. So there's a lot of businesses that our members continue to own. It's sort of the all-stars of entrepreneurs. And it's not just the labor shortage. You know, I went into our office the other day. We have 30 people. Only 2 are in the office. Everybody else is working from home. So in labor shortages, one of the things is how do you retain key employees? How do you give them the flexibility if they now want to work from home? But I think, as you've mentioned earlier on the program, this combination of supply chain issues and labor issues are creating new challenges, and you have to be really fleet of foot and be able to respond as a small-time entrepreneur. That's what a lot of our members are learning from one another, how to respond in these changing times.
You know, Michael, prior to the pandemic, you know, one could argue issue number one for most business people was climate, energy usage, green energy, and maybe it's taking a little bit of a back burner here during the pandemic, but it's going front and center now in Scotland. You know, they're getting together on a global basis to discuss these issues. What are your members saying about this?
So climate and energy are growing to be one of the number one topics that are discussed at our monthly group meetings when people get together all over the world. We're organized in groups of 15 people and have about 80-some groups today in 5 countries. And when they're talking about energy, they're trying to, it's not just the energy transition. This is going to be an opportunity set. If you're a commodity buyer, think of all of the copper that's going to be used to rewire the world. There is so much opportunity coming from the clean energy transition. There's estimates of between $2 and $6 trillion a year that's going to be needed to rewire the planet, to decarbonize the planet. It's probably the largest shift of investment themes, literally in the history of the markets. So you can be concerned about climate. You have every reason to be. But in terms of investing in new startups that are going to decarbonize the planet, this is an opportunity set like we've never seen before.
Hey, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We always love chatting with you, getting your perspective and the perspective of your members. Michael Sonnenfeld, chairman and founder of Tiger 21. They have about $100 billion in assets under management. And again, Tiger 21 is a peer membership organization for high net worth wealth creators and preservers, helping them to navigate the challenges and opportunities that success creates. I always love getting Michael's perspective and the perspective of his members as they navigate these financial markets and this reopening of the pandemic economy. Well, Matt, as I take a look at the economic landscape out there, one of the big questions I have is, where are all the workers? I see help wanted signs up everywhere, and then we're now coming to understand one of the key issues in the supply chain glitches. They can't find enough truck drivers to get the stuff out of the port. So where are the workers? I think our next guest may have some thoughts on that. Lisa Shalit, Chief Investment Officer
Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley. So Lisa, give me your best guess to where the workers are.
Good morning, everybody. So thanks for having me. As you may note, we put out a piece on this last week where, we suggested that the pandemic actually accelerated a bunch of structural changes that were probably already afoot with regard to the labor market. And our sense is that, right now, a lot of folks may be underestimating, number one, the portion of folks that retired and that retirement rate was accelerated around the pandemic. Our guess is as many as 1.5 to 2 million additional people permanently dropped out of the workforce because of the pandemic, and they were able to do so, quite frankly, because financial markets and their retirement savings recovered so quickly and so fully. A second group of folks, we think, relocated and really took advantage of the ability for many jobs to, quote unquote, go remote or move to a hybrid model that, really created a mismatch between, the supply of labor and the demand, the geographic demand for labor. And it doesn't seem like some of those relocations are unwinding. And a third piece is what we would call, the retraining and repositioning of folks that, were in positions that were deemed, quote unquote, non-essential. And during this last 18 to 24 months of the pandemic, those individuals, said, hey, the heck with that. I'm going to, use this opportunity, to train myself, to get certified, to move into a role that is considered more essential and more stable, I'm not going to go back to some of those service jobs that carry high stress and high public health risk.
I can tell you a couple of those hit home for me. My parents both had been wary of retiring, for financial reasons, but they've just done so well recently in markets that they've decided to pull the trigger this year. So, and then in terms of the retraining element, we talk so much about truckers on this show, but I have been looking seriously into what does it take to get, your long haul license, your CDL, and get a job, not just like local delivery job, but a real, follow that white line kind of job across the country. It's not easy. It's really difficult. It takes a lot of time, and obviously to make the big money, you need a lot of experience. So retraining takes a while. In light of this, Lisa, why are we still at all-time highs? We got this supply chain crisis. There's a labor shortage. Everyone's talking about real inflation, and yet we're at 45-51. What's going on?
Yeah, look, I think that there's two, fundamental things. One, we know that this is a market that continues to be awash in excess liquidity. While a couple of the measures that we use to look at financial conditions have begun to suggest a little bit of tightening, maybe at the ultra front end of the curve, the reality is that there's still a ton of cash out there. Morgan Stanley has done some work in the last, 2 weeks talking about the role of the individual investor, who's been, still seems to have access to ample balance sheet reserves to put into the market, that is a segment that is, quote unquote, buying the dip. And so we have a lot of liquidity and money still very much eager and willing to participate in this market. I think the second thing is that despite the headlines and despite, downgrades in GDP growth for Q3, despite the Delta variant, so far, corporate earnings are holding up. Now, our measures that look at forward earnings revisions say that the breadth of those earnings revisions has begun to roll over, that these topics of inflation and input costs and lack of labor and supply chain are going to be a factor. But it doesn't seem that thus far in the reports that we're hearing they are a big enough factor to throw water on this market.
So real quickly, Lisa, 30 seconds, where are you telling clients to go right now?
Yeah, so look, we like the cyclical story in Q4 and 2022. So we're buying financials, we're buying industrials, we're buying materials, we're buying energy. We believe in continued, you know, CapEx and investment cycle. We believe in the housing cycle. So those cyclical oriented issues, which tend to still have a little bit better valuation support than maybe, you know, some of the quote unquote work from home or evergreen stocks that have dominated the index is where we're focusing.
Lisa, thanks so much for your time. Always appreciate getting a few minutes with you. Lisa Shalit, Chief Investment Officer for Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley. This is Bloomberg. Well, let's get back to the markets right now. We can do a car talk segment.
Yeah.
I'm up for that.
We'll get Barry Ritholtz on.
But right now, let's get to, we have a guest who has, I think, a pretty out of consensus view. Well, maybe not.
No,
Jay Hagai joins us, founder, chief executive officer, and portfolio manager at Infrastructure Capital Advisors. And I've heard other people suggest that we could be going into a recession, Jay, because the consumer confidence numbers have just fallen off a cliff. And you don't typically see that kind of drop without a recession. But you think the Fed will be to blame when we finally get there. Why?
Well, first of all, thanks, Paul and Matt, for having me on again. Well, we think that the Fed has lost control of inflation. Specifically, they increased the monetary base by 83% since the beginning of the pandemic. And that has had a huge impact on housing. They've lowered mortgage rates to an all-time low. And now housing prices are up 20%, rents are up 10. So we see that we think that the run rate inflation level is 10%, which sounds pretty radical, but I guess it seems today conservative because there was a tweet that we're in a hyperinflation, which we definitely think we're not. That hyperinflation, by the way, is commonly defined as 10% per month. And we're talking 10% run rate per year, so we're an order of magnitude more conservative than that. But we do.
It would still be the highest we've seen since, you know, the early 80s, right?
Correct. Well, there was one important thing, and I would urge all listeners to focus on the housing sector because it's been involved in 11 out of the last 11 recessions since World War II. But the reason, in my opinion, that the Fed got away with quantitative easing after the financial crisis is we had 4 million extra homes. So we had a huge, it took 5 years to work those off. So they got away with increasing the monetary base, you know, at similar percentages. But this time we have really the opposite, where we have kind of normal construction and no excess housing. So that's why you're seeing this accelerated inflation. And also energy has its own separate dynamics. Natural gas is trading at the equivalent, oil equivalent, of $180 a barrel. And so that's when we mark to market on a run rate basis, the BLS estimates of 5.4, we're getting right around 10. And it can be worse. In Phoenix, their rents are up 23.5%, so it would be more like 13 in Phoenix.
How much of these inflationary issues, Jay, do you believe are transitory as the Federal Reserve continues to claim, or and how much of them are you know, maybe a little bit longer term?
Well, the best way to frame that debate is to recognize that most of the Fed is Keynesians or neo-Keynesians. So they tend to focus on cost push inflation. So some of these you know, production issues. Monetarists, like Friedman, would call it too many dollars chasing too few goods. So that's kind of the debate that's raging, but we've never had 83% and also the magnitude, you know, $3 trillion of extra money in the system. So I would argue that the recent data means that the monetarists, which is right now numbers about one on the Fed, which would be Bullard, are winning the debate.
What do you do as an investor? You're a portfolio manager, so it's not just about these forecasts or talking about what could happen. You've got to put your money in the right place so that you hopefully make more than your benchmark and definitely don't want to be losing any. Where do you put it?
Well, we have funds that are focused on preferred stock. So we have tilted that away from the low spread preferreds and into the higher spread, which happen to be also inflation protected. So REITs and pipelines and real assets, utilities. So we think that those funds should do well if we're correct about a rising inflationary environment. And then we also run a pipeline ETF. So we're kind of just fortunate that energy and real assets are likely to continue to appreciate. So it's a little bit easier for us to do that. We don't run a multi-strategy equity fund where we have to sell tech and buy energy, what other rotations we'd have. I do think that next year will be adult swim for investors, and being more defensive and being in yield stocks like REITs, utilities, preferreds is a good way to play. And even if you miss out on a few rallies or continued tech rally, you still get paid to wait. So yep. I think next year will be better to be defensive.
Jay, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate chatting with you. Some, I would call them, as Matt suggested, some out of consensus calls here on the economy.
Although Danny inflation. Blanchflower was saying the same thing to us a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, yeah. Good for Danny. Jay Hatfield, founder, chief executive officer, and portfolio manager for Infrastructure Capital Advisors, joining us on the phone from New York City. He believes that there is a 50% chance of a recession in 2022. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.